WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. My name is Jason Mann, and with me today is Robert Newsome of the Professional Wrestling Tumblr blog. Robert, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks again for having me back.
No problem. Great to have you back. We, of course, talked about Starrcade 88 the first time. Today we're going to talk about Starrcade 1994, Hulk Hogan taking on The Butcher. And who is better known, of course, as Brutus Beefcake, Hulk Hogan's longtime friend. And this is quite an interesting time in WCW's history. You had Hulk Hogan coming into the promotion in 94, and not just coming in and beating Ric Flair and kind of really easily, not really having like the kind of like competitive feud that you would kind of, at least I would imagine WCW fans would hope for, with like the two biggest icons of the 80s finally having a feud that everyone could see. But Hogan really dominated through that, and really the character of WCW completely changed when Hogan came in.
I agree with that 100%. I had kind of dropped out of regular wrestling. This was the little trough before I really got back on board, really around, I heard about this thing that they were going to do called Nitro, and that drew my interest. But before Nitro came on, the Hogan Savage WCW kind of rematch that they had brought me back in casually. But I was keeping up with it, and you're absolutely right about that Flair thing. It could have been, well, I don't know. We've all heard the Tiffany song about what could have been. So let's just apply the words of Tiffany's could have been to professional wrestling in 1994. I think you'll find it matches up perfectly.
Yeah. And Tiffany, wrestling's always like 5 or 6 or 7 years behind pop culture. So that would apply here, you know.
That's true. Except, and this is called foreshadowing. Except in the case of this match, they were only about 9 months behind popular culture on this one.
Okay.
And really, the setup for it was only a few months behind.
Okay. All right.
I'm talking about Tonya Harding.
Yes, you are,
we'll,
of course.
We'll get there.
Okay. Well, we can start there if you'd like. I mean, the basically the setup for this is we're in the midst of the Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair feud. There is a masked man who is attacking Hogan in certain periods, including and I actually watched this live, and this was one of the very first times I ever watched WCW. It was during Clash of the Champions. Flair and Hogan had a rematch after Hogan had won the title from Flair. Hogan is coming out for the match, is attacked, is clubbed by the masked man, I think with a baseball bat or a tire iron. I forget exactly what it is.
Yeah, I can't remember either, but I do remember the guy all in black, had a black hood on, and some ambiguous, to use the words of Nancy Kerrigan, some hard stick thing.
Yes.
I just watched the Kerrigan attack video right before I got on with
you. Okay. So well, can you explain, for people who are young, can you explain basically the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing?
1994. In January of 1994, during the training for the 94 Winter Olympics, a promising young figure skater named Nancy Kerrigan was attacked by an unknown individual, and her knee was battered right after she'd left the ice practice session, and it took her out of some preliminary competitions. Eventually, it emerged that her competitor in the Olympic competition, Tonya Harding, had hired a man named, hilariously enough, Jeff Galooly.
Yes, who I believe was her boyfriend or ex-boyfriend.
Either ex. There was some convoluted thing there.
Sure.
and had hired this gentleman to attack Ms. Kerrigan on her way out of the building or off the ice. And so it took her out of some competition. Ultimately, it didn't work. Tonya Harding did not win. I don't know. She
competed, but she didn't win. I don't know if they ever proved that she hired him exactly, but it was obviously very sketchy.
Well, she has been banned for life from figure skating.
Oh, well,
and,
there you go.
And she is she's doing the celebrity boxing now.
So oh, nice. She's okay.
And she definitely has a boxer's physique rather than a figure skater's. If you look at current pictures, look, I'm not going to lie to you. I went down the Tonya Harding rabbit hole on the internet before we talked.
okay.
I thought, I'll just look at the video because there's parallels. And boy, did I find out a lot about Tonya Harding.
Okay, well, very tonight. Good. I will defer to your expertise, of course.
Oh, please don't.
I think the one thing we should mention about that before we get back into the angle is that Tonya Harding very much kind of like a little white trash, a little bit like, rough, a little bit, that kind of thing. A working class, let's say, blue collar.
An unpolished gem.
Right. Whereas Nancy Kerrigan is very much like a princess, very much like a, very delicate, very has mm-hmm. kind of a upper crust, sophisticated air. Like there was very much there's a conflict there. I mean, this really captivated people in 1994. I mean, this was a big deal.
It was a very big deal.
Yeah, and the Olympics itself, that made that must watch. I remember watching that. I remember, kind of caring about that. And I was 15, that's not prime caring about women's figure skating.
For once in my life, I actually watched Olympic figure skating. And
right.
I don't think I've ever done it before or since, but it made me care. I still remember, and I didn't even have to go to the internet for this one, that Tonya Harding skated to the Jurassic Park theme during her Olympic routine.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's etched in my brain forever. I can't remember my sister's birthday, but I got the Jurassic Park theme from Tonya Harding.
So. Well, it's interesting how the mind works. So anyway, we have including that attack, we have other attacks by a masked man, including one in which Brutus Beefcake, who they are calling Brother Brudi at this point because they can't use the Brutus Beefcake name. Yeah, Brutus Beefcake has trouble with the names, which we'll get into as well. But anyway, we eventually it leads to Halloween Havoc 94. Hogan beats Flair in a cage match, which is Flair is retiring if he loses, which that didn't last too long, but not that Flair's retirements usually tend to last too long. That's not really a thing he's good at.
No.
Then basically like 5 seconds after, like they don't even like bother to give Flair like any sort of like my career's over moments. Like they completely move past that. So a masked man attacks Hogan. Hogan dispatches him fairly easily, pulls off the mask, and then suddenly it's Brother Brudi and Bobby Heenan's call. That man has butchered a friendship. They emphasize the word butcher like 50 times before the end of that show. Like they really, butcher, butcher, butcher is clearly the forced catchphrase at the end of that, which is very, very clumsy, but it's very WCW. Well, very wrestling. It's,
And, it's interesting to me, too, because Heenan should have been behind that 100% because he, he hated Hogan.
Which he is very much staunch in this match as well.
Oh, Heenan's on fire at Starrcade 94.
Yeah.
It may not be wrestling's finest moment, but in terms of Heenan and WCW, he's got some just brilliance is flowing out of this man,
especially given the he's saying everything that would later come to be true when Hogan turns heel,
right, and his hatred, whether it's legitimate or not, for Tony Schiavone is just palpable.
Yes.
Here it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to listen to, even if the wrestling isn't top quality, and it's not. The Heenan commentary on this is just amazing.
Right.
So, especially, and I don't know if I'm getting ahead, but when they show Jimmy Hart being awarded PWI's Manager of the Year trophy,
yes.
Heenan's reaction to that, where he thinks he's going to vomit, and it comes back from the video clip and his feet are up on the desk and he's rolling his eyes and rubbing his head. I mean, he is just on fire here. It's a great moment in Bobby Heenan's career.
Yes. Yes. I'm just gonna call him Beefcake because it's easier.
Can we call him Zodiac?
we can call him whatever you want. But he joins along with Kevin Sullivan and the Avalanche, who is better known as Earthquake, John Tenta. They are the three faces of fear, and this is sort of the precursor for the Dungeon of Doom, which would run amok in WCW through 95 and some of 96.
And would bring out one of my favorite stupid characters in all of wrestling, the Shark.
Yes.
Which is also John Tenta.
Yes.
The Shark. I loved that gimmick so much.
Yes.
And when he came out of being the Shark, to bring it back to Heenan, when he had that face turn after he was a Shark and he just became Big John Tenta, Heenan said, "It took 6 months of therapy to convince this man he's not a fish." Oh God, it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Yeah, I'm not the biggest fan in the world of WCW Heenan, especially as the years went on. But you know, it's still Bobby Heenan. I mean, it's still greatness. It's still brilliance personified.
I think the reason that I am such a fan of that is because I've read his book, and his book is amazing because it puts everything in a whole new light. When you read his book, you realize that he hated every second that he worked for WCW, which yes. is, you know, which is interesting because he certainly stayed there a long time. But to go back and re-listen to his commentary and hear it through that lens, through that filter, is really enlightening, because some of the things that he says go beyond just a bad guy commentator being a bad guy commentator. It is legitimate spite and actual hatred coming out. And it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful to hear, because here's a man who absolutely hates what's going on, but is getting paid to sound like he hates what's going on. And so it must have been really easy for him to denigrate everything he saw.
Yes, that's an excellent point. That is well said. I it's been a while since I've read Heenan's book, but he definitely did not think a lot of Tony Schiavone, does not think a lot of Eric Bischoff, does not think a lot of WCW in general.
And, you know, I think it's a common theme. Nobody thinks a lot of Tony Schiavone. And I've talked to a lot of people because, you know, I live in Georgia. I live in Athens, Georgia, and Tony Schiavone does broadcast work for the University of Georgia sports teams. He's on the football games. He's on the basketball games. And so I know some of the guys on the local radio station just, you know, from living in this town. And they all know Tony Schiavone, and apparently he won't talk about WCW that much. He's kind of quiet about it. He kind of lays back. It's just a period of his life that he's kind of put behind him. And it's really weird, because you'd think that somebody that involved would have a lot to say and a lot of pride, but apparently it's something that he doesn't really talk about that much. And I'm surprised that we haven't seen an RF video shoot interview or a book or something, because there seems to be a lot there. But everybody in wrestling, and I know I'm rambling, that I've talked to that's worked with him has not a lot of great things to say about Tony Schiavone. And it's interesting. I can't really speak about it one way or the other, because I never met the guy or worked with the guy. But
sure.
People have strong opinions about Mr. Schiavone, and they are, in my experience, rarely positive, with the exception of the non-wrestling people who work with him. All the people who work with him in local radio seem to think he's a great guy. So.
Okay. Well, maybe just one of those things where – I mean, it seems like Schiavone's work – and I've talked about this before. I think we've even talked about it – is it got – I mean, it was, I think in the 80s and early 90s, many times it was very good, and it was very good. And clearly it seemed like he was burned out or less interested or just less focused or whatever as the 90s went along. And I've heard that he was sort of one of the people who was in line to, or thought he was in line to be the next guy, the next boss in WCW in like 93-ish. and instead it went to Bischoff. And then it's sort of the idea that, you know, he kind of lost interest from there or knew he wasn't going to be in the power structure, so it was just sort of coasting as the announcer. Now, I have no idea whether that's true, but that's something – that's a theory that I've heard thrown out there.
Well, a lot of people have said, and in my upcoming fanzine that I'm working on, plug, I talked to Bob Mould of Husker Du about his time in WCW, and he said that Schiavone was kind of he referred to it as working for the other side in terms of hiding finishes from other commentators or not telling the booking committee when certain wrestlers could and couldn't make television. And Bob Mould used the example of Silver King being booked in a match on a Nitro and finding out 2 days before the live TV happened from Schiavone that, oh yeah, he can't do TV this week. He's booked in Mexico and things like that, where any little bit of information that Schiavone would get would be hidden from the people that would benefit until the last possible minute. Now, again, this is Bob Mould's word, and look, the guy was in Husker Du, so obviously I'm biased towards him, but you know, that's what he said about it. And he's not the only person that I've heard that about Tony Schiavone from.
Sure. So. Interesting. So anyway, we have Three Faces of Fear. There's a Clash Six Man with them and Hogan and Sting and Dave Sullivan, not yet Evad Sullivan. That is inconclusive. The bad guys end up clearing the ring, and Beefcake has the sleeper on Hogan for a very, very long time. The idea that the sleeper being this deadly hold that will hurt Hogan if it's on for too long. I don't think anyone bought that, but
well, it cuts off the blood flow to the brain.
Well, yes, yeah, of course. But I think even by 1994, the sleeper was not regarded as a dangerous hold by just about anybody. It is certainly not today. I mean, it's just sort of like a random, like somebody would try. I mean, very, very few people win a match with the sleeper. I guess Dolph Ziggler was using it for a while. I remember Triple H being Jeff Hardy with the sleeper once, which was kind of random. But for the most part, at this point, the sleeper was not really super dangerous.
Yeah, I think the bloom was off the rose on the sleeper at that point. Indeed. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah. So one of the things of intrigue here is that Randy Savage is in WCW. He has not wrestled yet. There's a tease here into whether he will be behind Hogan or not. I think the line was that he's either going to shake his hand or slap his face.
Mm.
So go ahead.
I don't remember that being said, but that's a good one.
Yes.
If it wasn't said, then you should say it, because that's yes.
Okay. So we have Butcher come out first. He has a ponytail and sunglasses, so you know he's the bad guy. He rips apart the Hogan shirt and stomps on it. He comes out with Sullivan and Avalanche. He's making very, very comical, exaggerated faces. I don't think they're not intended to be comical, but yet they are comical. Like, he's really working hard to coast as a bad guy, if that makes any sense.
He is, I refer to it as playing to the back of the room. Where,
yes.
You know, if you're on stage and you can't project, or, you know, you're trying to convey something, you make things broad and loud and big and exaggerated. And he's definitely playing to the back of the room here.
Right. But there's a way to do that effectively, and there's a way that he's doing it. And those are two different things, I would say.
I do also think that when he first came out, I was shocked because I thought he looked like Mongo.
A little bit, with a ponytail, right.
With the ponytail and the sunglasses. All he was missing was a leather jacket and a chihuahua.
Exactly.
And he would have been the greatest member of the Four Horsemen in history.
Right, something like that. So we also have Commissioner Nick Bockwinkel, who was WCW commissioner for a couple of years. Didn't really do much of note there. It was kind of an odd fit for him. But I note that he with everyone who's in the ring, he is by far the best wrestler there. Probably the best wrestler at that point, too.
Well, you know, it's weird about Nick Bockwinkel because he was huge in the early 80s. And he's one of those wrestlers that didn't make the transition for some reason. He wasn't over with the passing of the torch of that generation. You have people like Harley Race, we'll talk about him later, who's, you know, can't wrestle He's injured, but he's with Vader in a managerial capacity, so he's still a known quantity. And then you have, of course, Ric Flair, who started in, you know, the mid-70s, who's obviously still going strong at this point. And Hogan was around, you know, in the early 80s as well. But Bockwinkel was kind of left behind, and I often wonder if that's because he didn't have the best gimmick. He was just Nick Bockwinkel. You know, he wasn't Nick the Hulk Bockwinkel or Nick the Nature Boy Bockwinkel. But you're absolutely right, and I think he's underrated, and he only through kind of going back and watching his matches on grainy videotapes on YouTube have I kind of come to appreciate him.
Yeah, I actually I've been watching a bunch too, because I'm starting a feature on Retrospective, plug for me, Wrestler of the Month, where I'll be looking at matches for one wrestler every single month, you know, and writing a bit about the matches and talking about just everything I can find in his career. I'll be sharing every day, and so Nick Bockwinkel is the very first one. So in January 2012, for anyone listening this far in the future, I'll be examining as much about Nick Bockwinkel as I can. So I think it'll be interesting to see what is discovered.
Yeah, I definitely can't wait to read that, because it's a valuable exercise, I think, because there are a lot of people like Bockwinkel that were huge at a time and
right.
didn't transition for whatever reason into the wrestling that I grew up with, and probably you, and, you know, people of a certain age.
Yeah. Well, it might also be, you know, it might also be partly by choice. I mean, Bockwinkel may, you know, some of the guys you're talking about are in wrestling because they have to be, you know, where Bockwinkel doesn't, you know, he seems like a guy based on interviews. He seems like a pretty smart guy, maybe just saved his money, maybe just doesn't want to do it. I know he still does some of the, like, the conventions and the circuits. And I think he's really big into the one out in, California, Arizona, Cauliflower Alley, that one.
Oh, yeah,
he's really big into that. But yeah, so and he's, you know, he's done a few Legends things. He did he's in the WWE Hall of Fame, and he was out, I think, I forget if it was earlier this year, if it was last year, but he was out there for, like, they had, like, all the Legends out there as, like, lumberjacks for some sort of lumberjack match on Raw at some point. So he looked really good. I mean, he's, you know, in his 70s now, but because he was in his early 50s at, you know, at the end of, like, in his last AWA championship run. I think he was 50 when, with his famous hour-long match with Kurt Hennig.
So, I can't imagine.
I
can't even, like, jog a mile. So,
right. So we have, so Hogan comes out with his music. Then we have the introductions by Buffer. He introduces Butcher first, then he introduces Hogan again. And for some reason, Hogan's music plays again for the second time.
I noted that too. And can I just say briefly that, that Buffer's introductions last about 4 hours. he goes through this whole thing about the, you know, these men were friends, and now they face each other as mortal enemies. And
right.
The man who has left him in his hour of need. And he just goes on and on and on. And I don't know if he was getting paid by the word or what happens. I mean, I know for a fact that Buffer's booking cost is different according to whether or not he says, let's get ready to rumble. And
right.
Just let's get ready to rumble costs several thousand dollars. So if you want Buffer and you don't want let's get ready to rumble, you can get him at a discounted rate. So if you guys are booking any independent bookers out there,
interesting,
keep that in mind.
I feel like if you had Michael Buffer and you did not get let's get ready to rumble, you would have, like, angry people.
Oh, I think there would be a riot.
Well, I mean, hopefully it doesn't come to that, but I always thought Buffer was weird having Buffer there. I always thought Buffer was, like, I don't know. I thought Buffer was distracting. I didn't see the point. I always kind of thought he was silly, but whatever.
I kind of always saw his presence as a kind of a bid for legitimacy.
Right.
Because this is the guy who's in front of the boxing crowds and the, you know, the fake combat sports, as I call them.
Sure.
And you know, so we've got him here, and this is giving it legitimacy. just like when they brought in, you know, the boxers as guest timekeepers or guest referees, which would happen from time to time.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess that's what it was. But he stuck around through Nitro. I mean, he was like, I mean, he did most of the Nitro main events for a while, at least.
Yeah, he did. He did the Hogan Goldberg title match when I was there. And when he said it, I'm telling you, man, that it got a reaction from the crowd. The guy next to me who and I'm going off on a big tangent here, and I apologize. But the guy right next to me who literally hugged me when Goldberg beat Hogan, a stranger hugged me. This guy went crazy when Michael Buffer said, "Let's get ready to rumble." So whatever he's got, it's working.
All right. Well, don't question Buffer. I guess that's what we learned there. So we have Sullivan and Avalanche are sent to the back. Jimmy Hart is allowed to remain, obviously, because he has a manager's license. You would think Kevin Sullivan would have picked up a manager's license as well, but
that's true. Oh, wait, one more thing. And
sure.
I'm sorry to go back.
No.
Buffer says he's talking about the belt. He says, with the belt captured from the legendary Ric Flair, he must meet an opponent obsessed with destroying him. And then he says the leader or the figurehead, or I don't know what he says, of Hulk Mania. And when he says Hulk Mania, you can see, if you look closely, you can see a slight reaction from Hogan. He kind of like almost like a little pinch. He just jumps a little bit like you seriously messed up my trademark. But he does say Hulk Mania, and he goes on and on about the belt got from Ric Flair. And it look, Michael Buffer's ridiculous. Anyway, so Bockwinkel, yeah, he sends him to the back. I'm sorry. Let's move forward.
I'm glad you brought those details. I must have just sort of tuned Buffer out. I missed that completely. So I'm glad that you were here to capture that. So we have we start off with Hogan pushing him repeatedly into the corner. Then eventually Beefcake takes control with some basic stuff. Hogan shoulder blocks him down, and then we go to outside. I like Heenan's description of like watching Andy working over Aunt B. And then
I'm so happy right now, because that is written in all capital letters at the top of the notes that I took.
Yes.
I'm so happy you brought that up.
Right. And then Tony Giovanni is absolutely disgusted by the fact that he brought that up and said, "It's not like that at all. Come on, you know."
The back and forth between these two guys, it's hard not to think that this is not legitimate hatred. It's beautiful. Guys, this match is a pile of garbage, but you got to watch it just to see this commentary.
Yes. Yeah, it's very, very weak, very, very, you know, standard. I will say I'm willing to call it energetic. I think you disagree with that, but I'm willing to say that at least, like, they're doing things throughout most of this. There's one nerve pinch that's a bit lengthy, but I don't think it's absurdly lengthy during the middle of it. But other than that, I feel like they basically are at least being active during this, which I appreciate energy from a Hogan good guy WCW match, because generally those were not that energetic.
It's energetic in the way that, I don't know, like when you watch your dad trying to play baseball or football with some kids like at Thanksgiving or something, and
sure,
he's out in the front yard and he's like, "Well, let me show you the way I used to do it," but his knees are bad and he's been smoking a lot, and it's like, "Dad, just go back inside." Yeah, it's energetic in that way.
Okay, well, okay, that's fair. You know what, at least I'm seeing things happening, at least my eyes are looking at motion, and you know, I can at least appreciate that.
So basically there's little distinction between you and a barracuda at this point. At least things are moving in front
right.
of my face.
Exactly. I'm getting some stimulation. That's important. So we go outside, Brutus sends him into the rail, and after a back rake, Tony says, "This is Butcher at his best."
And then is this before or after he chokes Hogan with the microphone
cord? That's right before. We have some back rakes, and then he gets to the and gets to choking Hogan with the cord. Referee doesn't really seem interested in counting these men out or threatening anyone with a disqualification. Or,
oh, no, no. And this is Nick Patrick, right?
I'm not positive.
Oh, it is. It is. I've got a note here. Yes.
All right.
It's referee Nick Patrick. And when Hogan is being choked by the cord, Schiavone says, oh, my goodness, he's got Gary Capetta's cord, the cord to his microphone. And Heenan quickly jumps on him and says, of course it's the cord to his microphone. What did you think it was, his umbilical cord? It is. He's just slapping this man around verbally. Honestly, the real match here is between Schiavone and Heenan. The booty man Hollywood Hogan crap that you've got going on is absolutely secondary. This is a Schiavone Heenan match from start to finish.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll give a little bit of service to the other match, but the back and forth there is quite it is quite brilliant. So we have Jimmy takes a chair from the butcher, distracting him. We get an atomic drop by Hogan, more weak brawling. Then Hogan hits him with a chair a bunch. And Hogan's being, I think, even more of a bad sport than he usually is during this time, which I guess, you know, you can justify because it's best for betrayal or whatever. But, like, he chokes him with the chair. Like, he's really, like, just being a complete dick here, which Bobby Heenan, of course, brings up because he would always bring that up when Hogan was doing that sort of thing. I mean, Bobby's angry at it, and he has certainly an amount of righteous indignation, but it wasn't quite – I always thought Jesse's was just a little bit more righteous.
Yeah, I think so too, and I think also – and Heenan does mention he kind of – I mean, it was a known quantity at this point, but he mentions Ed Leslie, Brutus, Butcher Man, Booty, Zodiac, Cake, whatever.
Okay.
He mentions his accident, and he says, you know, this is a man who had a serious accident.
Right.
He's got 85 screws in his face in three places. Hogan could change this man's entire appearance tonight.
Right. Yeah.
So he's definitely calling in the fact that a very serious accident, really real life, happened. And when Hogan goes after him with the chair, he brings that in to make it sound like it's, you know, a more serious and more legitimate concern for this man's well-being than actually should.
Yeah, but it's a good point. And Hogan punches him in the face repeatedly too. So he's going after the face. That's part of the that's kind of part of the story.
While Heenan is shouting at him to stop being a bit part in this man's life, and then Heenan starts yelling, "Be a star. Be a star." And he mentions Hulk Hogan's television show.
Yes.
Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling. And for the sake of comparison, I went back and watched an episode of Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling.
Uh-huh.
And it was more interesting than this match.
Very good. Well, I think the television show that he's actually thinking of is Thunder in Paradise.
Oh, boy. That show.
Yeah.
I could do an hour with you on Thunder in Paradise. I'll save it.
Okay, I've never seen Thunder in Paradise, thankfully. So
here's a spoiler alert: if you see a flower pot on screen, it will explode.
Okay, well that's good to know.
The terracotta budget for Thunder in Paradise for those gunfights must have run into the millions.
Nice. There's something I was going to say. Probably not important. The accident. We should mention it just for people who don't know that in real life, Bruce Beefcake was in a parasailing accident in 1990, I think, and was out for a while. And honestly, I think in like the couple years before that accident happened, Bruce Beefcake was not a good, but was a perfectly acceptable professional wrestler. You know, had a connection with the audience, was fine. And then when he came back eventually, it took him like a few, like 2 or 3 years to make a full-time comeback. But when he came back, he just really was not ever quite the same, understandably to a certain extent. Why you would put him in your main event of your biggest show of the year is when you know that those limitations is sort of questionable, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I don't really know much about the accident except that it happened, and I often wonder what the seriousness of that accident was compared to really the only other major accident that we've had in professional wrestling up to that point was Magnum TA, where he was in a very serious accident and it ended his career 100%. And
right.
So I kind of wonder if Brutus Beefcake or whatever he was called at that point was given those same kind of warnings. Now, I know that most of his damage was to his face.
Yeah, it was cosmetic. I guess it was cosmetic damage. I mean, it seems like he did seem much more like – he seemed limber before the accident. I mean, that could have been just with age, too, and the kind of shape he was in. I always assumed it was just sort of like facial, you know, reconstruction stuff. I mean, they always were like, you know, if he gets the wrong kind of punch in the face or whatever, his face could be in a million pieces. It was always kind of the line they had. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like he ever was – it ever really affected him in the ring. You know, never was had an injury related to that. I mean, certainly that never happened. So yeah, you would kind of wonder how much of it is just sort of like how they built it up versus what the reality situation was. But it did take him out of, I mean, I don't recall him wrestling before the 93 tag match, the WrestleMania one, the WrestleMania 9 one. I don't recall him wrestling between that accident and that match. He may have, but I don't recall it. So
yeah, I wouldn't know. I probably didn't pay attention to WWF until the mid 90s. So
right. So but anyway, I will say one before we get back to the match. I will say that I watched the Halloween Havoc 94. A couple of years later. So I didn't know the Hogan Beefcake story at all. I didn't know the turn was coming. So when I saw Hogan pull off that hood and that it was beefcake, I was like, wow, that was kind of like a big shock to me. So I think if I had seen it and watched this whole thing through with my WWF perspective, with not knowing the WCW stuff, with just kind of like, you know, just knowing that, I think I might have actually been sort of interested in this match. Now, I would have known this match would have been horrible, but I would have sort of been semi-interested in that feud based on my knowledge, what my knowledge would have been at the time, if that makes any sense.
It does, and I can tell you that the package that they put together to set this feud up, even if you didn't know, and I didn't know a lot of the stuff in there running up to it, it was really well done, and I think credit should go to the production team that put this together, because it did a really good job of succinctly explaining this feud to people who may not have known what was going on. I mean, even now, several years after the fact, when we're looking at, what is it, 18 years ago, it was a really good encapsulation of what was going on. You have the several masked men, where one of them is Brutus and one of them isn't, and Brutus fake comes to his rescue, and there's a brief interview with Hogan. There's also inexplicably a scene of Hulk Hogan flexing on the bow of a moving speedboat. I questioned the safety of that, but it was a really good package, and it did a good job of encapsulating kind of the whole feud thing. And I like a good masked man feud. I mean, the Midnight Rider, the even parts of the Black Scorpion were at least compelling.
Right.
If not good. So.
Yes, a good mystery in wrestling is always can be fun. You know, if a lot of them turn into sort of silly fiascos, but yeah, at least you know you're building something up and you're eventually paying it off. You know, at least you should be in theory.
Right.
So you know, you're always going to have that story at least, and it's always, you know, a good mystery is fun. So we'll give it that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always good when Jimmy Valiant leaves town and Charlie Brown shows up.
Sure. Back to the match. After the brawling outside, they slide back in. And the one well-executed offensive move in this match is Beefcake nails him with a pretty good knee lift.
I swear we wrote the same notes. I said that the high knee, and I called it the high knee because yes, that's what the booty man called it.
Right.
it was the best move of the match.
Yes, it was very good. So it was so well done. Nice job.
And then it leads into Hogan biting him in the face.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, we have we face him on the ropes. We got he does a power slam and then gets up at one. He doesn't want to do the pin yet. You know, he doesn't even want to try the pin yet.
No. And that's interesting to me too, because Hogan bites him and refuses to pin him, and that got me to thinking: was this match possibly? And there's really no way to know without talking to Kevin Sullivan, but was this the beginning of the planting of the seed for the eventual heel turn? Because I know that Sullivan was the major architect of the heel turn, which would come, you know, only 2 years after this. And 2 years is a long time, but it's also not, especially when you're talking about, you know, the slow moving glacial pace of professional wrestling sometimes. And so it kind of seems like this is where Kevin Sullivan could have said, hey, remember how much fun you had in that match against the Butcher? You could do that all the time. And I wonder whether or not this was where some of those seeds were planted, because Hogan was definitely doing some heel tactics in this match.
Yeah. Well, I could see sort of a, like, okay, maybe someday we'll turn Hogan heel, so we'll throw a few things in that will make it make sense later. Like, I could definitely see that. Yeah.
And I kind of buy Kevin Sullivan's ability to think that far ahead.
Yeah.
Because he's been responsible for some pretty solid angles, you know, in his career. And I know that in interviews I've read with him, he said that, you know, he was the one who was kind of pushing Hogan in this direction, and it took a long time. And he always talks about how long it took to get Hogan's buy-in on the heel turn, and how he wouldn't let anybody talk to him the whole day of the Bash at the Beach when it happened. And so I wonder if this wasn't the start of, you know, and if you're Kevin Sullivan, does a long time mean a couple of months, or does it mean 2 years? Because if it means 2 years, this very well could have been the beginning of that eventual turn.
Sure. So we have before that, Biffy misses the elbow. Hogan punched from the second rope. Hogan punches him down, does biting in the forehead, clotheslines him down, some more punching, and then Beefcake has like a sort of an odd exaggerated wobble after the clothesline into the corner.
It's not. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. It's not an odd little wobble. It is the single most ridiculous reaction to a move in the history of professional wrestling.
Okay. All right.
Without question, top of the list, the single most ridiculous reaction to any move ever in wrestling history.
Okay.
The dumbest thing you will ever see. And I know we can make fun of the Shockmaster for tripping over that thing, and we can make fun of the gobbledygooker all we want.
Okay.
This is the dumbest thing that's ever happened.
All right. Well, somebody needs to make like an animated GIF of it or something. And, you know,
it's the worst and simultaneously the best.
Okay.
So everybody look it up. It's on YouTube.
Yes. Yes. We have 10 punches in the corner, a bite to the face.
Although, no, we do not have 10 punches in the corner.
No,
I made a note of this.
The
crowd is denied 9 and 10. They count to 10, but Hogan only wags his finger at 8 and bites him in the forehead.
Ah, very good. Yes. I was not paying close attention to realize it was only 8. So we have Hogan telegraphic a backdrop. Then Brutus is able to take control after a kick. Some choking. Then we have the nerve pinch. The first one doesn't last long.
The first one is mercifully short.
Yeah. Then Hogan gets up, but then Beefcake chops him down, and with another one. This one is longer. Hogan powers out, and Beefcake cuts him off with a double chop to the throat. Interesting.
Right, and while this nerve hold is going on, but between the short nerve hold and the long nerve hold,
right,
Tony Schiavone says, look at this crowd. They're standing everywhere. And there's a shot of the ring from the steady camera, not the ringside camera. Mm-hmm. Very few people are standing. The crowd in this show is not into this match at all.
Not so much, no.
Not at all.
The finish. And they're in the finish, but
they do come back from the finish, and I think this might be later. I think it's during that second really long nerve hold, but something happens, and I don't know what. But the fans aren't even looking at the match. Heenan actually calls us out. He says, they're fighting in the stands here. But I don't know what that means, because was that just a misdirect? Because if you look at the crowd, everybody is looking at something that's happening to the right, to their right. Nobody's looking at the ring. If you're looking at the crowd, they're looking to your left, their own right. Something is happening over there. So I don't know if there was a legitimate fight in the stands between some fans. There may have been, because this match was so boring it made me want to fight somebody.
Well, maybe that's why they went back to the nerve pin, because if the fight was going on, they were distracted. That'd probably be something you'd want to do while, you know, while they finish that and then you go back to the match.
You're kind of a genius, because I had not thought of that. You're absolutely right. If there was actually something happening in the arena, maybe a long, drawn-out, motionless hold was the right thing.
Yes.
But for Heenan to reference that and say, hey, something's going on in the stands, and to have the reinforcement of that by everybody in the crowd looking far away from the ring. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, and I hadn't thought of that. Maybe they were just trying to kill some time while the real situation of excitement was dealt with.
Exactly. So we have the sleeper then, which Hogan goes down for a bit, then he tries to get up, then he goes back down again. Ref lifts the hand twice, and then it lifts it up the third time, and it goes pretty much all the way down, but Beefcake sort of releases it early. The hand goes back up. So Beefcake turns around. Hogan realizes that Beefcake is not aware that he is conscious. So he plays possum.
The most exaggerated fake sleep. I guarantee you, if you could have put a microphone close to his head, he was doing that Three Stooges snoring thing where you kind of whistle and go beep, 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 beep at the end. This is like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs when they're sleeping in their beds, and or in cartoons when somebody's sleeping with a newspaper or a napkin on their head and it's blowing up and coming down with their breath. Oh, just foolishness.
Subtly was not in any evidence at all in this match.
No, not one.
It was not subtlety, no. So we have Brutus realizes that the ref's not calling for it, so he goes for the cover. Hogan kicks out strong.
Hogan, I'm so frustrated by this. Hogan actually puts his hands on his own chest, palms up, before Brutus even touches him.
Okay.
He's so telegraphing that, okay, I'm going to kick out of this. He actually puts his hands on his chest, palms up, so that I don't know if it was a bad camera angle, a bad match call, a bad whatever, but before he's even covered, you know he's going to throw him up in the air because his palms are up. And how could the other man not see this?
You're very emotional about this.
I am, because this is why, as a child and a preteen, this is exactly why I never enjoyed the WWF. Because I grew up in Georgia, I watched NWA stuff, and when I saw the WWF, I thought, well, that's just cartoons. And in fact, the Hulk Hogan cartoon was some of my first exposure to the WWF. And so I always thought, well, that's fake wrestling. When people say wrestling is fake, what they mean is the WWF, because you've got Mounties and you've got, you know, you've got Hillbilly Jim, and these guys were hard workers, and there are good matches there, but I only realized that as a grown up watching it in retrospect. But as a kid, that was cartoon wrestling. Mm-hmm. And this match, even though it's in my beloved WCW, completely justifies why I thought the WWF was cartoon wrestling. This is two guys that were big in the WWF bringing that cartoon wrestling to the WCW. And I'm not saying ridiculous crap hadn't happened in WCW before this point. I mean, this was 1994. This was post Black Scorpion. This was post any of the ridiculous crap Sting and RoboCop had already tag teamed. I mean, sure. So ridiculousness was happening, but this was definitely a cartoon wrestling match.
Yes. And as we, you know, talked about a little bit before, is, you know, Hogan's presence changed WCW, just, you know, the tenor of it. I mean, WCW kind of was on creatively was in it, going in an interesting direction in 94. You know, you had Flair back on top, you know, working with Steamboat. You had kind of an interesting hardcore division headlined by, you know, Cactus Jack and in the tag teams with against the Nasty Boys with Sullivan and Max Payne at different points. So, you know, you had kind of some interesting things going on in 94, at least something that would have, like, appealed to, like, kind of the true wrestling fan. You kind of had a mix, and I think I talked about this a little bit in the last podcast on with Flair Vader. You kind of had the mix of the kind of the new hardcore style with, like, kind of the old Southern wrestling style. You just had some kind of some nifty stuff going on. You know, whether it was successful or anything was debatable, but at least as far as being entertaining, you know, kind of up and down, you had some really cool things going on. You had, you know, kind of Steve Austin was coming into his own. Pillman was doing some interesting stuff, or was going to be doing some interesting stuff. I guess 94 wasn't his best year, but, you know, that kind of thing. You know, up and down, you really had – it was starting to come into his own after a difficult 93.
And 94, I could be off on this, but I seem to remember 94 was when Pillman had the feud with Austin, right? That's when the tag team broke up. That was very interesting to me. I thought that angle was really good. The Pillman Austin feud, the breaking up of their tag team, and then them kind of turning against each other. I thought that more could have been done with that. But yes, right. I agree with everything you said. But you know, at the same time, I mean, it's not exempt from its ridiculousness. 93 93 we had Bongo the Caveman, which was a dumb thing that was abandoned quickly enough that very few people remember it. But
I've never heard of that.
Bongo the Caveman was a gentleman literally carrying a club, wearing like a Flintstone style toga made of animal skin, who would show up kind of just wandering through the crowd at on Main Event. And, you know, very few people watched Main Event because, let's be honest, it was kind of boring. But right. That was, you know, I watched it every week. And I still have tapes of it. Basically every Main Event from probably 91 through 94 is probably in this room with me right now. But Bongo the Caveman was a gentleman dressed like a caveman that would just wander around through the crowd. And I think they put him in the ring one or two times. But, you know, and also in the mid-90s, they had almost a changing of the guard because, you know, Tommy Rich was still working there, but he had been knocked down the card. You know, he was tag teaming with like Rude Dog or, you know, Buddy Lee Parker. And you know, you had a lot of those guys that were around in the old days that were still kicking around in the ring, but it wasn't much longer before they kind of left really quietly. And so you're absolutely right. 94 was a really weird time, and there was some good stuff that came out of it. But when it started to stink, it really – boy, yeah. It did stink.
Yeah, yeah. I found a GeoCities page from a guy named Tim Parker who apparently – played Bongo the Caveman, which he says was on and off. It's like an FAQ with him, like, talking about different things. He said he was Bongo the Caveman on and off between 92 and 94. It says he almost landed a contract, but they would never give him a push. They made me walk in the aisles of this character like Fred Flintstone, which I enjoyed playing, but they never gave me any action. They never offered me a contract, so he went to the IWF in Orlando. And was part of some sort of team called the Heartbreakers. His name is Tim Powerhouse Parker. So, anyway. The first thing I found when I Googled Bongo the Caveman WCW. So.
Do they have his promo shot? I remember a black and white promo picture of
yes,
him.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Everybody look at that.
Yes.
Everybody Google Bongo the Caveman.
Yeah, super. Oh, boy. Interesting. Wow. I mean, there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of wrestling, you know, that I haven't watched, but, you know, I've done my research. I've seen, you know, I've read things and seen things, and most of like the wrestle crap type stuff, I at least know about a little bit. So it's unusual for something like that for me to never have even heard of it. So you're expanding my knowledge base.
It was definitely, I'm serious. If you didn't watch every episode of Main Event like I did, you definitely would never have seen it.
Yeah. Interesting. So, where were we? Oh, Hogan kicking out Strong with palms up.
Right.
The other thing I like about this match is when Hogan points, when Hogan does the point, you know, in his comeback, Beefcake staggers back, like it's like a stunned look on his face, and he staggers back like it's like the most like afraid that he's ever been in his entire life. And I like that as well. That was a nice moment on Beefcake's part in this match. Those are the that and the knee lift are basically the saving graces, of course, besides the wonderful, you know, Heenan and Tony sniping at each other.
Yeah, and it was, I don't know, I think it was it made Hogan look really good. And yeah. I think that you know, when a guy dominates a match like this, it's difficult to see it at the time, but you have to give the other guy credit too. And I think that if something good can be said about this match, it is that that Ed Leslie is either incredibly incompetent, which I'm not prepared to believe, or really worked hard to make Hogan's comeback as big and as meaningful as it could be within the context of this pile of garbage that we'd sorted through up to this point. Right. Because once that kick out happens, there really is that, you know, it's the standard Hogan comeback, but it's a little more violent because we'd seen the biting and we'd seen the choking before this. And so I think the Butcher does a little more to make it seem like he's really hurting more than the standard guy who gets the big boot and the leg drop.
Right. Right. So we, and then we, as Hogan's about to finish him off, we have a Sullivan, running in, and then Avalanche sort of trotting in. There's not much of a run there.
He trundles.
Yeah. He's trying his best. I mean, he's a big guy. So, Hogan fights all three of them off, but the camera does linger on Tenta as he is getting there, and you can tell that, you know, that he is not a fast man, you know.
No. And I told you this before we started this, but I cannot explain myself here, but I am a John Tenta apologist.
Okay.
I like that man.
Okay, well, that's good. I like him a lot more now, but when I was young, I did not like him very much at all. Like, when he became, like, the top bad guy in WWF, like, in 1990, that feud with Hogan, like, that was, like, one of the things that turned me off on WWF and wrestling in general. Like, him, for whatever reason, he was, like, just a thing I did not like. I like him now, but then for whatever reason, he just did not do a thing for me, which makes me think before we get into this is like the thing that was weird about WCW 94 trying to emulate old WWF is it wasn't emulating like the classic WWF, like the 86, 87, 88, like when they were at their peak. It's emulating like the 91, 92, 93 years when they were past their peak.
And like, I wonder if there were any members of the creative team that had moved from one to the other, because it almost seems like that would have had to have happened for it to have emulated it as strongly. I mean, obviously you can watch the product and say, hey, they did that, let's give it a try. But
yeah. Well, I assume that was mostly Hogan's influence of bringing in his pals, and it was guys who he was comfortable with and that sort of thing. So I think it was probably more just that than any – you know, but you know, you might be right. Who knows? I mean, I don't know who went from where exactly, you know, during those years.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't know a whole lot about what was going on behind the scenes at this time.
Right.
I mean, you know, as far as who's actually calling the shots there. I mean, I have to assume that Hogan wouldn't have come in without a contract that gave him some level of creative control, whether it was as great as he had in the mid 90s or I'm sorry, the late 90s in Nitro, you know, the NWO era or not.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure it was pretty substantial. So we have – anyway, the run-in happens. We have Hogan fighting all three of them out, hitting the big boot and leg drop and winning the match. Hogan grabs a chair, and then they're all sort of at a standoff. Savage runs in and just sort of like a, it's kind of a long extended sort of thing where he's negotiating with the Faces of Fear. He shakes Sullivan's hand and I think Beefcake's as well. Teases Timmy with the bad guys. Go ahead.
And what do you think he was saying, like in real life? I've always wondered that when they're in the ring and they're talking to, but they, you can't hear what they say. I really want to know what is actually being said. And I know that, like, you know, you see some episodes of Botchmania have where you can clearly see that they're calling moves, but this was more than just a setup. I mean, all you know is somebody's getting hit with a chair. So I really need to know what he was saying. So if Kevin Sullivan's listening, if you could just send me an email, let me know what he was saying. I'd really appreciate it.
Yes. Yes.
Or if Hogan's listening. I mean, let's not play favor.
Yeah, Hogan was there too. Yeah, he could. Yeah, Savage and Tenta can't tell you. But Beefcake, I suppose, could.
Yeah, so. Beefcake's still around. So yeah. Ed Leslie's out there.
Right. Just
send us an email.
Yes, we would appreciate it. So we do the eventually he helps Hogan clear them out. They do a little bit of the staring thing. They kind of, you know, they're a little tentative with each other.
And can I say also that the first chair shot that Hogan gives to Butcher is the weakest chair shot in the history of wrestling.
Ooh, I've seen some. I feel like I've seen weaker Hogan chair shots than that. I mean, it was weak. There's no question about that.
Oh, but it was bad. There's a lot of superlatives in this match, but yeah, it was a really horrible chair shot. And I think, just very briefly, for people who don't want to watch this, I don't blame you. He has a chair because previously, before this match, was the Avalanche Sting match, and the Avalanche Sting match was also interfered with. The Faces of Fear came out and caused that match to end in a disqualification, and Hogan came out to Sting's defense and had a chair then. So he came to the ring for this Butcher match with a chair in his hand.
Right. And I believe everyone's like, he did the he sat on Sting's ribs. I forget the move, what they called that, but when it was Earthquake, there was some sort of name for that move. It doesn't matter. His finishing move, and Sting was hurt and all that kind of
the
thing.
Avalanche Crusher. I don't know.
Okay, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but I don't know what it was.
Yeah. So they stare at each other for a bit. They kind of communicate a bit. They sort of semi-shake hands, kind of do a little bit of like their individual posing. Then they have like a real like firm handshake, and then Savage sort of joins in doing the Hogan poses. So
right, but it's not a firm embrace. It's not like when somebody would take off a shirt and have an NWO shirt on under it. You know, it was really kind of a tentative feeling each other out. I said out.
Right.
Moment here, you know, and it was really weird because it's not until, and I guess we're going to get to that, but it's not until the post-match interview where there's a real kind of sense of the permanence and seriousness of the alliance that's happened.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. And of course, you know, they Savage and Hogan would tease the problems in the future as well. But for a while, they're buddies. The Mega Powers are back. They use the term Mega Powers. So we have, you know, Savage joins in, does the Hogan poses. They head to the an interview later in the locker room with Hogan.
And this is where it gets good.
Yes. I just want to point out, Savage is there. Both Nasty Boys are there. Alex Wright is there. Brad Armstrong, Dave Sullivan, Johnny B. Bad, Jimmy Hart, Nick Bockwinkel, and someone else who I think might be Scott Armstrong, but I'm not sure.
I didn't know who that was either.
I think it's an Armstrong.
I couldn't tell.
And I think it's either Scott or Steve, but I'm that's just a guess. It looks like it looks like an Armstrong. So
I watched this on YouTube. And okay. There's no way to blow it up. I couldn't tell. But Johnny B. Badd in street clothes looks utterly ridiculous. and Sags is holding a blue solo cup the whole time. And when you watch this, and I know all of you will, watch the interview one time all the way through. That's great. Then go back and only watch Sags's face. His reactions to what Hogan is saying are priceless, because the Nasty Boys were face at this point, and yeah. they were friends with Hogan, and you know, obviously Jerry Sags and Hulk Hogan are friends in real life, and they train little people wrestlers.
Yeah.
Oh, is it Knobs?
Yeah, it's Knobs.
I thought Sags was in that show too. I have not watched.
I'm not sure. My understanding is Knobs is closer to Hogan. I mean, and I know was on the show more, or at least I don't know. I know they've had more of an association. I don't. Sags may as well, but I haven't.
Is Knobs Knobs is the blonde one, right?
Knobs is the blonde one. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So it's definitely Sags who has the blue solo cup.
Right.
You got to look at his expressions are priceless. His reactions to this. I mean it. Oh God. He's basically trying to make this whole thing about him, and it's wonderful.
Good to know. Who's the one who gets in Vader's face? Is it Knobs or is it Sags? I guess it's Knobs.
I think it's Sags because he's standing right beside Hogan.
Okay.
And then Mean Gene kind of moves in the middle of him.
Right.
And they're all back there. And actually, when Hogan starts the interview, he says, "You know something, Mean Gene? I got to tell you, brother. Whatever, whatever, whatever."
Well,
says,
no, actually, before we say the whatever, 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 I will say that it's sort of a different promo from Hogan, because it's sort of like he's forlorn about the fact that he had to fight Beefcake and that they were friends and he wanted to turn him around, and it was sort of a different thing. It wasn't like the bragging Hogan, you know, type thing. It was actually like expressing a little bit of a different sentiment than you normally would have in those circumstances.
I think you're right, and I think I was probably wrong to whatever it, but what I was rushing toward, and I hadn't really thought of that, but you're right, because Mean Gene even comments, "You look a little down in the mouth," and of course he would be, because he just had to battle his friend.
Sure.
But Hulk Hogan says, "The only thing I can say is, ooh, yeah," in reference to the Macho Man being there. And this is almost completely dropped because nobody reacts to it. But Randy Savage is – yeah, obviously he was a crazy person, and he was one of the best interviews in wrestling. He actually says from the back of the room with his back turned to the camera, he says, "Ooh, yeah, wait a minute. Where's the Digit?"
I missed that.
He was so angry that his catchphrase wasn't said in its entirety that he yelled from across the room, "Where's the Digit?" So
that's beautiful. I'm going to be rewatching that interview as soon as this podcast is done.
So yeah, Sags is face of, and then of course King Harley Race, who he's not king at this point, but right. King Harley Race and Big Van Vader come in. Yeah.
He's blonde though. He's very blonde here.
Oh yes, quite yeah. So.
Race wasn't always blonde in WCW. This was
a new look for him.
Yeah,
new look for him. I think one of the things I like about Harley Race's appearance, and you don't see it here, but it's obvious in photographs, is he's one of those old men with a tattoo on their forearm. Mm-hmm. You know, which was a thing for tough guys to have back in the, you know, when Harley Race was probably at his toughest. And by this point, if you see pictures of him in short sleeves or shirtless by this point, this tattoo, I don't even know what it is. It's just a mass. It's just a black kind of stain on the top of his forearms. And I really like it when old dudes, you know, you see World War II veterans with their unit insignia or whatever, and it's faded to just this black splotch. And I always like that about Harley Race, but that's a real big aside, because the main point is Vader comes in, and literally after Mean Gene says, "What the hell is that?" Vader barges in and says, "You shut your mouth. It's time to listen to Vader."
Yes.
And that is the best way to announce your entrance into a conversation. You shut your mouth. It's time to listen to Vader.
Yeah.
And it was.
Yes. And we have Vader. Vader goes on a pretty good rant, too. Just sort of, you know, bemoaning Hogan, says he threatens him. He tells him that he's afraid. You know, it's to the point where Hogan gets, like, you see the anger in Hogan. Hogan didn't really, like, talk angry, you know, like, I mean, he would get angry in like his matches, but it was sort of like a, you know, light anger. Hogan wasn't great at conveying anger so much, but here, you know, you can kind of see Hogan as a character, you know, just really like, you know, feeling a bit demeaned. He shows a little bit of fear, I think. I mean, I think he's kind of conveying some interesting things here. I really dug the first stages of the Hogan-Vader feud. The Super Bowl V match, the first match of their feud is just fantastic. It's by far Hogan's best good guy, probably Hogan's best match in WCW, honestly. Probably, you know, his best match since Warrior Hogan, I would think, you know.
I'm not a huge fan of Hogan or Vader, but I do agree with you that that match and the beginning of this feud was really well done. And I think Vader was shown as a legitimate threat. It's also interesting that this is one of the few times, and well, not few, but it is rare, that a guy will go into the wrong dressing room.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see them cross over backstage. I mean, they'll fight in the hall, or they'll fight on the way to the hall or in the parking lot. But the dressing rooms, you know, when a guy goes into another guy's dressing room, it is definitely a big deal. I mean, it yes. happened. I remember as a kid in the 80s when Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair were in the same dressing room and Shivani was trying to keep them apart back when he had a mustache. That was a big deal to me. It's like, wait a minute, these guys have separate dressing rooms for a reason. He shouldn't be in there.
Sure.
And it definitely is something you don't see often. And I kind of like that. I like that crossing of boundaries is used sparingly,
right,
or relatively so.
Sure, sure. So eventually, you know, they kind of Hogan retorts angrily. They kind of get in each other's face, but it's broken up fairly quickly. Vader and Race leave, and then Mean Gene gets Hogan's thoughts, and basically they're obviously teasing very heavily that it's going to be Hogan and Vader. Vader had won the U.S. title earlier in the show from Jim Duggan in a weirdly great match as well. By far Duggan's best match in years before that. So Vader was kind of bouncing back after, you know, he lost title to Flair a year before, had another match with Flair, kind of, you know, meandered a little bit through most of 94, but obviously bounces back and had a pretty big 95 until he left WCW and went to WWE, and that didn't really go so well. So kind of later, Vader's kind of last stand is like really the old, like tough, like, you know, threatening Vader.
Right. And you're right about the Duggan Vader match, two guys that I could care less about, but you know, it was a good match. And then Alex Wright, and Triple H or Jean-Paul Levesque had a decent match in this one. Mm-hmm. There was also a Johnny B. Badd match that we will not really talk about that.
Okay.
Although it was against Arn Anderson, and I love Arn Anderson, but I just, you know.
Although Johnny B. Badd was pretty good at this point. I mean,
he was, but, you know, he looks like Little Richard. Let's call him Johnny B. Badd, and oh. And he barely looks like Little Richard.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Whatever.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we have Mr. T against Kevin Sullivan.
Oh, I forgot that this was the Mr. T. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that completely blocked that out of my mind. I will have to watch that. That just intrigues me. I'm sure it's awful, but it's only 3 minutes, four minutes. So.
I did watch this whole show, and it's all on YouTube. But I did watch the whole show once and then this match a few times because I knew we were going to talk about it. But I mean, it's not a bad show. It's not the Super Bowl of professional wrestling. It's not a Starrcade for sure.
Right.
But it's a decent show. I mean, I don't know about the Mr. T match or,
right.
The Harlem Heat match was okay. Harlem Heat Nasty Boys was decent. And then something I didn't know and read about, you know, after I watched the whole show was that the Johnny B. Badd Arn Anderson match was supposed to be Johnny B. Badd and Honky Tonk Man.
Yes, that's right. I remember that. I forgot about that too. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course the Elvis versus Little Richard match that everyone was waiting for.
Right. And honestly, I think I would have enjoyed that more just for that angle. the Elvis versus Little Richard aspect of it. And then, of course, we could have had the Freebirds, Heavy Metal Van Hammer, of course, the Rock and Roll Express, and all the great music-related acts could have been involved in that somehow.
Jeff Jarrett?
Yeah, well, sure. And then I guess the Billy Gunn was a roadie at some point. I think basically what we're doing is fantasy booking a all-music-themed battle royal.
That would be fantastic. I would love that. Yeah. So, yeah. anyway, I think we're done with this. I think we've pretty much said what we need to say.
Unless I'm still thinking about that music theme battle royal now.
Okay, yeah.
I kind of wish I hadn't said that.
Max Payne?
PN News?
Okay, yeah. Well, John Cena.
Oh, Lord. And didn't Randy Orton, doesn't he sing his own theme song?
I don't believe so, no. I don't think so.
I see that song in his face, and I always imagine him singing it. But
Jimmy Hart, of course, would have to be involved.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And has there ever been a jazz gimmick? Any wrestling jazz men?
Gosh, I feel like that needs to be something. But
The great Power Udi. He comes to the ring playing a saxophone.
Okay. I'm only vaguely familiar with the great Power Udi, so I did not know that.
Yeah, he's the king of Nigerian pro wrestling.
Okay.
He's not good, but
I know Tom Holzman loves him. So
I saw him wrestle at an indie show in Athens in the Clark Central High School gymnasium, and boy, it was a wrestling match, that's for sure.
All right. Was it better than this or not as good as this?
It was not as good as this.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was. he was wrestling a guy named Hans Baumgartner, who's a bad guy German gimmick.
Okay.
You can tell he's kind of supposed to be a Nazi, but he's not really being a Nazi. He's just, you know, he's German.
Sure.
And, you know, he goose steps occasionally, but
sort of a Baron von Raschke for the modern.
Right. Right. There's no swastikas or anything, but it's heavily implied.
Yeah. And, Baron von Raschke pretty much was too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And, the great Power Udi was, you know, he was pulling his punches a little much, but apparently to hear the Cliff Compton and Luke Gallows interviews from their time in Nigeria, he's, you know, they take it pretty seriously over in Nigeria. So
okay. Interesting. Well, I know you've got a lot of things going on. You've got your zine, of course, you got your Tumblr, and why don't you tell us about what you want to tell us?
The fanzine's coming out. I'm taking my time with it. I'm hoping to have it out by, you know, March or April. I've got interviews with Bob Mould. Ultramantis Black is going to, I'm going to be talking to him and have some stuff in there. Some comics from people. I keep promising myself I'm going to write a match-by-match review of Halloween Havoc 2000.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't even make it through the first match.
Okay.
On that, it is terrible.
Yes.
But I'm gonna do it. So if you guys want to hear or read some guy you've never even heard of write about the Chronic Goldberg match, oh Lord. And then of course professionalwrestling.tumblr.com. Mm-hmm. I'd scan old magazines and cram them on the internet. And there's
great
so
stuff.
Many.
I enjoy it.
Oh, thank you for saying that. There's so many people doing it now that I found out. I mean, obviously they were doing it before me, but they're doing such a better job of it. These people have access to so much more material. So I'm going to keep that going for a while. And then I've got, you know, the stupid Twitter. It's atomic_elbow. You can hear me or read me write about wrestling matches and complain about things.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm good at.
Okay. So. Well, I always enjoy your insight into things, so we'll definitely, keep checking that out. And
I appreciate you saying that.
No problem. And
and one more thing. If anybody in or near Athens, Georgia, is listening to this, which maybe not, Championship Wrestling at Flickr is going to be coming back in January at Flickr Theater and Bar, downtown Athens. classic wrestling videos from 8 until midnight on the big screen there. It's going to be January 24th is the next championship wrestling at Flickr. So if you're in or near Athens, Georgia, come on down and we'll watch some wrestling and eat popcorn and do whatever. So, well, yeah.
Sounds great. So anyone in the area should definitely check that out. And thanks again for being on the show.
Literally my pleasure. Anytime you want me to do this, I love it. I absolutely love this.
And thanks everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed it, and we will talk to you again soon.
Goodbye.